presented by the American Petroleum Institute.
On Wednesday morning, Frank Fahrenkopf received a letter from the Biden presidential campaign that ruined his day. Fahrenkopf is co-chair of the Commission on Presidential Debates, which has produced 33 debates since 1988, the first year it was in business. He was planning on four more this year, three with Biden and Trump, and perhaps a third-party candidate if they qualified, as well as the quadrennial vice presidential debate. But the Biden campaign told Fahrenkopf that the president would not be participating. It said the commission's debates were too late in the year, after many Americans had already voted early, that the debates had become noisy spectacles. And the Biden campaign complained that in 2020, the commission didn't enforce its own debate rules. Instead, the Biden campaign announced that it would negotiate with the Trump campaign and individual media organizations to plan two debates outside of the commission's process. By the end of the day, Biden and Trump were set to debate in June on CNN and in September on ABC. That left the future of the Commission on Presidential Debates very much in doubt. I went out to Fahrenkopf's house in Virginia to talk to him about all of this. We sat at his dining room table, and he took me through a slide deck about the commission and its history. You may hear some papers rustling. And he had a lot to say about Biden, Trump, Anita Dunn, Rudy Giuliani, good and bad debate moderators, why he thinks RFK Jr. may have grounds for a lawsuit against CNN, some amazing behind-the-scenes stories from his decades producing debates, and why he believes the commission ain't dead yet. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. All right, so Frank, you've got a handout for me here. Tell me about this.
It's a set of slides that explains what the CPD is, how we came into being, what's the history behind it, what modifications have we made over the years with regard to primarily the format, how we proceed and do things, who's on the debate commission. And I think the best way to start is in 1960, when we had the famous Nixon-Kennedy debates. We then went 16 years without any debates. First of all, after the assassination, there was no way that Lyndon Johnson was going to allow Barry Goldwater to get up on the stage with him. His attitude was, and to some extent, George Herbert Walker Bush's attitude was this, that if you're the president of the United States and you allow somebody to get up on the stage with you and debate you, you're raising that person's dignity, profile, and so forth.
And that essentially was the default position of incumbents.
That's exactly right.
Until what, 76?
Yeah, it started 76.
So let's just quickly, so obviously we've got the famous Nixon-Kennedy debate. Then we went, Nixon, after that debate, he wasn't very fond of televised debates because this becomes important later.
Anyway, you got through that. Then he didn't participate in the next two cycles. Then we get to 1976.
Yes, right, 68 and 72, Nixon anti-debate,
no way.
Not doing it.
Not going to do it.
All right.
And so the League of Women Voters comes on the scene, and in 1976, it didn't look like there were going to be debates until the pardon. And when President Ford pardoned Nixon, boy, his numbers went in the tank. And Governor Jimmy Carter said, well, it's debate. And so he finally, Ford agreed to do it, which was not a wise thing.
You forget one detail about this, if I've got my history right. Ford actually made this such a big deal, he mentioned it in his convention speech, a challenge to Carter, I believe.
You know, I was there. I don't remember that. But I'm getting old. I forget a lot of things.
This was out of desperation in a sense.
Really, in a sense it was. And as we know, that was a terrible performance. In effect, said that those countries behind the Iron Curtain were not under the influence of the Soviet Union and so forth, and it was over by then.
It's the one line people remember from that debate.
That's correct.
I couldn't tell you anything else from that debate but that one.
But then 80 was a very, very interesting year because there was a third-party candidate for the first time.
Yeah, and this is relevant to our discussion today for sure.
John Anderson, a congressman from Illinois. The League of Women Voters had what we call the 15% rule, which we still use, which says that in order to be participating in the debates, you must be at a balance of average of 15% in the major polls. And so when the first debate rolled around, John Anderson was at 17, I believe, and he was invited to participate.
You're forgetting one other, correct me if I'm wrong, but they also had the electoral vote criterion as well?
I'm not sure that, you know, that's a good question. I thought about that the other day. I'm not sure what they had. I don't recall. Now, like we have, you've got to be on enough states on their ballots conceivably get to 270. I'm not sure it was.
Okay.
And so he accepted. John Anderson. They got Governor Reagan, who was the Republican nominee. He accepted.
Interesting that Reagan accepted a one-on-one.
At the time, he didn't know.
Because
then they called the president, President Carter, and President Carter said, hell no, I won't go. I won't go if John Anderson's involved. And believe it or not, I went to that debate, that first debate. It was in Baltimore, and it was Ronald Reagan and John Anderson, just the two of them.
Well, this was before you were
chairman. I was then the chairman of the chairman. I wasn't the national chairman. I was the chairman of all the state chairmen.
Oh, got it. Okay.
And we had state chairmen out of Nevada. Yeah. And so then by the time the next debate rolled around, he'd fallen to 12%, Anderson, and he was not invited. Reagan accepted. Carter accepted. And they just had the one debate. The very famous line, as you remember, is, there you go again. And do you feel better today, whatever it was, than you did 4 years ago?
Yeah.
Which was key.
But it was the famous line about diffusing the issue of age.
That took place the next time, 84.
That was 84, sorry.
84,
okay,
yeah.
Mixing up my history.
Yeah, in 84. So then 84 was also, so that was the first time that there was a third party candidate involved. And he got involved because of his numbers at the time, and he made it. In 84, still the league. And what occurred was, for some reason, which I'd never really explained to me, the League of Women Voters gave the two campaigns the right to veto any member of the Journalism Society who might be named as a moderator or a panelist. And as you know, there used to be one moderator and three reporters.
Yes.
And the two campaigners vetoed over 100 journalists.
So they just went reporter by reporter.
Jury
selection.
That's exactly right. Like peremptory challenges.
But they had an infinite number of, of challenges.
Well, that created, as you know, a real, real mess.
It must have been a real badge of honor for the reporters who were on the veto list.
Yes, yeah, yeah. they probably have something hanging on their wall now, I'm sure. And then that led to the creation of two study groups, which you've got before you on page 4.
Right.
One was the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is at that time was at Georgetown. And the other was Harvard University's the Kennedy Institute of Politics. And they both weren't studying just the debates. They were studying the whole process of how we elect our presidents and vice presidents. There were journalists. There were college professors. There were candidates. It was a real mix. Paul Kirk, who was then the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, when I was chairman of the RNC, we were on the one at CSIS. And interesting, and it just turned out that way, that both of them, without internet, came to the same conclusion concerning the debates, that there should be created an entity that does exist for one purpose only, to conduct the general election president and vice presidential debates, not the primaries. We've never had anything to do with the primaries. Paul and I met. We both went back to our committees, and we formed in 1987 the Commission on Presidential Debates. And it's a private, not-for-profit corporation. It's nonpartisan. Yeah. A lot of the media says it's bipartisan. It's not. It's nonpartisan. A bipartisan entity couldn't qualify under the Federal Election Commission rules to do debates.
All right. I want to talk about some of those changes, because this is what the Biden came. I want to take you through the letter that they sent you yesterday.
Yep.
And I just want you to respond to the different criticisms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to get.
There's a lot of mistakes.
Well, that's why it's important. Let's really get detailed on this, okay? I'll read them.
Go ahead.
But if you have the letter, when did you get the letter, by the way?
Yesterday morning.
Same as everyone?
Yep, same as everyone.
They list several reasons that, quote, the Presidential Commission model for these debates is out of step with changes in the structure of our elections and the interests of voters, all right? And there are three biggies here. So their first one, let's go through them. is that the commission's schedule has debates that begin after the American people have a chance to cast their vote early and doesn't conclude until after tens of millions of Americans have already voted. And they, you know, they take a swipe here. The commission's failure, yet again, as if you guys have been warned, to schedule debates that will be meaningful to all voters, not just those who cast their ballots late in the fall or on election day, underscores the serious limitations of its outdated approach.
They didn't do their homework.
All right. So,
and I know where all this is coming. This is Anita Dunn. This is her. This is her plan. I know she's fought. She was against the commission for years and years and years, and was part of a commission. And I think Ron Klain was on it also.
The Annenberg report.
The Annenberg thing. Yeah.
I want to
ask.
And we have some questions about that.
Yeah.
So you think this is coming from Ron and Anita?
There's no question. There's no question.
Have you talked to Ron?
I haven't talked to Ron in a while.
Got it. He has been your liaison to Democratic campaigns for like the last five Democrats?
About the time he left the White House, I think he sent me an email or I asked him, I don't remember now, it was an email. We didn't talk on the phone. If the president debates, will you be advising him as you've done? And he said yes. So that's the only thing
I've
got. Now, I saw him on television a week ago or something where he said that same thing.
Yeah. When you were working on this stuff with him as liaison to the Democratic presidential campaigns, was he generally expressing dissatisfaction with CPD?
We had a great relationship.
Yeah.
We had a great relationship.
Okay, let's go back to number one then.
Okay.
The early voting issue.
All right.
They
didn't do their homework because we did our homework. This all started when I assume former President Trump got the RNC, because he controlled the RNC, to say they were withdrawing from the Commission on Presidential Debates, which I found very interesting, how you can withdraw from something you never belong to.
Right, they're not a member.
We have no contact even with the parties. We only deal with those people who are the nominees of parties that are on enough ballots to get to 270 votes and meet the 50. We don't deal with the parties. And so it was, you know, that was put up and said, it's because you haven't moved the dates. Well, you got to go back to 2020. We were in the middle of a little disease problem. And so many states, because of that, changed their laws to go back to allow early registration so there could be voting.
Right.
And they're correct. There were a lot of votes cast prior to the first debate. Now, we had set the dates for a year before. We didn't know what the situation
was. Way before the states had changed their rules.
So what we have done going into this cycle is we've checked the laws of every single state as to when we should go forward. And there's a very key date. It's the 6th of September. The 6th of September is the final date when a number of states declare who's going to be on their ballot presidentially. Not till then.
So you can't know the third-party candidates qualify until September 6th.
That's correct. It's the funny thing is the date that they picked, June 27th. At that time, there are only seven states who have concluded their work on who can be on their ballot in the fall. And
so
they make up 110 total of electoral college votes.
All right, so RFK has absolutely no chance of getting on the ballot for that debate.
Well, unless on that debate, yeah. Now, the only thing that would be interesting is, aren't the Libertarians having a convention in the next week or two?
They are. Here in Washington, at the Washington Hilton, it's around the 24th or 25th.
And they don't have a candidate yet.
Right, and he's going to be speaking
He's going to be speaking. I think he challenged Trump to debate him there or something like that. I thought I saw, or maybe challenged Biden. And
so this is an intriguing possibility.
There are four parties that automatically, because of the past years and their involvement, will automatically be on the ballot in all the states, or at least to get to 270.
Yes. Yeah.
That's Republican. That's Democrat. That's the Green Party. And Jill Stein, I think, is still out there. Will probably run again. And the Libertarians.
Right.
Who have not nominated. So if they were to nominate him, he may already be at the place where he's beyond enough ballots to be 270.
Right, that September 6th date is no longer the main thing for him. He gets the Libertarian line across the country. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then he would have to hit the 15% in time for late June.
I saw a recent poll, he was at 16. I didn't balance any or average something.
He's averaging less than the 15% threshold. But this is one question I had for you is, and we'll get back to the letter in a second. Do you think that the Biden campaign was partly driven by making sure there's no chance RFK is on that stage?
Yeah. From everything that I've heard, you know, I've got a lot of friends who are still Democrats involved in the Democratic Party. Some are in the White House. They don't want Kennedy in there. Now, I've seen a number of polls. Some say it hurts Trump. Some say it hurts Biden. But Biden's in such deep trouble in the numbers. Why take a chance?
This is kind of funny because one of the things that CPD has been accused of is keeping the third parties out, and you know, just it's a cartel of the two big parties. But you guys actually have straightforward criteria for the third parties, whereas now the Biden and Trump campaigns going straight to the media seem to have boxed out third parties
under
completely.
The Federal Election Commission rules. If you're going to sponsor a debate, you have to put out an objective standard of what the requirements are.
That goes for the media organizations?
Yeah. We have been sued starting in, I think it started in 88, in almost every single cycle. I often jokingly told my partners on the commission, I made a bad decision in 1987 when we created the commission and I became chairman. I should have taken on the general counsel because the amount of millions of dollars we paid in attorney's fees over the years. Challenges, it started with Nader. It started with Perot when he didn't get on the second time. Buchanan. I mean, on and on. We've been sued in every cycle. The cases have gone. So one case has gone all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. We've won every single one in the federal courts. Sustaining, it's primarily the 15% rule that they're attacking.
Got
primarily it. The 15%
rule. That's de facto eliminating
That's right. And we've won every single. The only time it wasn't that I remember was Obama versus McCain. When it was announced that they were going to be the candidates, we got so many letters saying Obama doesn't qualify because you got to be 35 years of age and born in the United States. And someone was saying that he was born into Africa and not
in the United States.
He was a prominent national figure who was talking about that quite a bit. Yes. But interestingly enough, we got a hell of a lot of mail the other way on John McCain.
Because of Panama.
Panama. He was born in Panama on an air base. But, yeah. You know, and we did a little research on that, and it's funny. If Lyndon Johnson would have agreed to debate Barry Goldwater, we'd have had the problem because when Goldwater was born, Arizona was not a state.
Right.
So, right. Yeah.
And just to be clear, because a lot of the criticism of the CPD mm-hmm. is now, I think, fairly going to be leveled at, or at least questions will be asked about the media organizations. And so I want to go through some of that.
Yeah.
And the what you're saying, and I didn't know this, mm-hmm. is that the FEC, right, mm-hmm. requires that a presidential debate sponsor have eligibility requirement for third parties.
It says that there must be objective standards.
Got it.
For who's included.
So
I believe that also includes networks, because the only people who can do it right now are us and
right,
and networks.
To produce
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is an interesting question is the Biden campaign is basically saying there's no chance that they would have agreed to any debate where RFK Jr.
This is 101. In fact, I think they had CNN promise that they wouldn't let him in
right.
regardless.
So could that potentially violate the FEC rule here?
It could, but my lawyering days are over. I'll leave that to the lawyers on both sides. I don't know, but it's an issue of certainly to raise.
Okay.
I'm surprised that
very interesting.
When this thing went down yesterday, I said, boy, I bet Kennedy's going to file some lawsuit somewhere. He's going to file some, you know, it's pretty.
If you were him, now, would that be the first place you'd look?
Yeah, what do you got to lose? Give it a shot.
Yeah.
Give it a shot and attack it.
All right, that's interesting.
Okay,
now
what else?
Let's go back
to
the early voting. Yeah. How did you guys try and address this?
So we went to every single state and came to the conclusion. We looked at the calendar. I'll show you our calendar right here.
Yeah.
And we looked at in August. In August, what do you got? You got the DNC convention.
Yep.
You got the end of the Olympics, which end on the 11th of August. So August is pretty bad. Then you get to September. You get Labor Day, NFL
second.
Football every Thursday. And that's when we knew the important date of the 6th.
Yeah, you got
that's
it circled
the,
on your calendar here
on
for
the calendar.
That can't see.
And that's when we started. The only people, and they say on here, millions of people will vote before the first debate. Now, there about 900,000 voted 4 years ago before the first debate because of, you know, with the coronavirus and so forth. Now, there's only one place that votes could be cast. I think it's North Carolina. Hang on a second. Yeah, in North Carolina, if you want to vote by mail, you can apply for a ballot and receive it on September 6th, and you can vote it.
That's the earliest.
That's your. And every other state is later.
So, and your first debate would be scheduled 16th. For the 16th.
Yes. So it's only those people in North Carolina who went in early enough and cared to get their ballot and vote.
For nearly 4 years, the American people have faced the pain of high inflation and global conflict. Now, more than ever, it's time to end political gamesmanship and implement policies that help benefit Americans. Let's work together on solutions that help address the consequences of inflation and secure our energy future. Visit lightsonenergy.com/energyleadership to learn more.
So the Biden campaign has accepted September 10th as the second debate. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, if they get a first debate, they might take a shot.
That's the ABC debate.
Yeah, that's the opening of the U.S. General Assembly on that day.
Do you think Trump will come back and say, Biden, you don't have to come because you're going to be at the U.N. just like Bob Dole?
Well, I think he speaks at the end. I've got here, he'd probably speak on the 24th.
It'll be after.
Yeah. But the interesting thing about, I thought, their choice was, particularly about the first debate, that they've scheduled it for Thursday, and hoping that the trial is going to be over on a Wednesday. And it just happens to be when the president's returning from having his picture taken with all the leaders of the G7. So it's very, very clever. I mean, I hand it to them. They were, the Democrats did a pretty clever job here.
So in other words, what you're saying is by doing a late June debate at the end, very, very close to Trump's his trial, mm-hmm. maybe the lowest moment in the campaign for him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, he might be criminally, he might be
found a criminal violation, yeah.
And right. But the president coming back from the G7 right. as the leader of the free world.
Yeah.
So
pretty clever. I mean, timing, if I was doing it, I gotta give them a prize. You know, I thought that the smartest thing, and it brought back to me what they did in 2020. When we did the first debate, and we were in Salt Lake for the second, the vice presidential debate, when we get the news up, the president is really sick, down with it. And I had a hard decision, and we decided that we were going to cancel the town hall meeting in Miami. We had some of our staff on the platform, sound, some folks. You know, Trump would never wear a mask on there. And one of them told me, his wife was on, said, stay away, you know, don't. And we were starting to get a little trouble with picking people in Miami who would be willing to go on the stage with the campaigns in the town hall meeting.
Staff and production staff?
So we decided, well, listen, everyone's doing stuff on Zoom and so forth now. Let's say, all right, it's canceled in person, but let's do it and Zoom it. And immediately, Donald said, I'm not doing that. He's going to be in his basement. Everything's going to be on the board for him, and they're going to be handing him notes and all the rest of it. Well, I talked to his people. They knew that wasn't going to happen. Wherever he was and wherever Biden was, there were going to be people from the other side. There'd be reporters and so forth. But Trump said, I'm not going. I'm not going to not do it. And immediately the Biden campaign said, okay. They scheduled, I think it was an ABC interview that day or rally or something, so that even if Trump changed his mind later, it was too late.
They took advantage of that.
They took advantage of it. I thought it was a brilliant political move.
There's been some debate about this among political strategists, and I think I know where you're coming from on this. Do you think that the Trump campaign, just from a campaign strategy, missed a bit of an opportunity here in acceding to all of Biden's requests this week so quickly?
You're talking about what we're dealing with right now? Yeah.
I mean, the way I look at this, it just seems, and not everyone I've talked to agrees with this, but from my vantage point, it seems like Trump got played here.
Did you see Halperin this morning?
I did not, no.
The Biden campaign took advantage of Trump's prowess and willingness to debate on any terms to win a slew of process advantages that are materially in Biden's favor and which allowed him to play Mar-a-Lago like a fiddle. No live audience, no audio mud wrestling, probably no live awkward walk out onto the stage, on cameras, no RFK, four moderators who are, shall we say, unlikely in the extreme to perform their duties in a manner that will work to Trump's benefit. That last point might be the most important key. We've all seen a gigantic role of the moderators' choice of topics and opportunities for referring have played in the past presidential debates. Depending on how this all ends up, ceding those debate about debate process points to the Biden campaign could end up being one of the great blunders of the entire election cycle.
Do you agree with that?
I think, yeah, I do. I do.
Yeah.
Someone called me this morning and said it was political malpractice.
Wow.
Calling on the staff. Now,
Of the Trump campaign.
Of the Trump campaign.
Yeah.
But you know, I looked at it and I thought back at what happened in 2020. Donald makes decisions like this, and I'm not sure he listens.
And he posted on social media quick last night.
That's correct. That I don't think when he just, I'll do whatever they're going to do and I'm going to go wherever. I don't think he ever saw all of the details that were in there. And that is pretty spectacular job by the Biden people. Yeah.
The other part of a debate about debates and setting things up is the expectations game. And
yes,
Trump keeps saying that Biden
is the worst in the world. Yes.
That's not usually the winning strategy,
no,
is it?
You usually say, God, they're good. I don't know how I'm going to keep up with this when I get my turn.
All right. That's good stuff. All right. Let's go back to the letter. Mm-hmm. And their mm-hmm. second attack on you guys is, do you take this stuff personally? That letter was pretty tough.
And you're familiar with the Annenberg thing, and we knew what they were doing, and knowing that Anita was there, and Anita hates us and always has. And so, I don't take it personally.
Got it.
We're in politics, for God's sakes.
Yeah. All right. So Anita, or really it's Jen O'Malley Dillon, who signed this letter, says the commission's model of building huge spectacles with large audiences at great expense simply isn't necessary or conducive to good debates.
Well, but see, they're getting mixed up.
They talk
primary
about
debates.
Noisy spectacles of approval or jeering.
When come in the hall and you have your ticket,
yeah.
It says you're not to make any noise or disturb or you'll be escorted out. I've done 33 of these things and there was only two times that the audience ever disrupted and clapped or so forth. Now, sometimes they laugh if something funny happens on stage, but there's no booing. There's no yelling. It's not like the primary debates, where if you go to them in the primary, the networks who do it want that, And of course, they do advertising and all the rest of it.
No advertising in the CPD debates.
Not ours. And we're 90 minutes without a break, and we've never done it.
So when they describe your debates as entertainment for an in-person audience with raucous or disruptive partisans and donors who consume valuable debate time with noisy spectacles of approval or jeering.
That is false, and they know it's false. I mean, they were there last time. There's no cheering that goes on. Now, the one example, and it had a very, very, I guess, negative effect on the moderator. We tell the moderators that this is different than if you're interviewing a candidate who comes on your television show or you want to interview him for your magazine and so forth, and you ask them a question, him or her, and they give you an answer, which is different from an answer that they said publicly a week ago. So naturally for you to say, well, wait a minute now, Senator, or whatever it is, you're changing your position. A week ago, you said, that's not your job. That's different.
It's not Meet the Press.
It's not Meet the Press. And so your job is to be a facilitator. And if one of the candidates is changing their position on something, they're debating. The other debater should say, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
So the most you should do in that case is sort of, maybe.
Exactly right.
Turn it over to the opponent.
So what do you say about that?
But if they miss the opportunity, it's not your job to fact check.
It's not the job to fact check.
This is an important point, and this is going to make some people mm-hmm. mad at you, I think, mm-hmm. or some people disagree with you. You don't think the moderator should fact check these candidates at that debate?
Not at the debate. Nope.
That's not their job.
They're facilitator. And where it happened was with Candy Crowley.
In 2012.
2012, the former governor, of Massachusetts, Romney, accused Obama of not condemning the bombers as terrorists. And Obama said, well, I did say it. And he said, no, you didn't. You had a chance to say it, but you didn't say it. You didn't call them terrorists. And suddenly Candy Crowley said, oh, yes, he did. And Obama was very quick. He turned to Candy and said, say it again, Candy. And she did.
He recruited the moderator to his side.
That way, I looked, and Mrs. Obama, when that happened, of course, that big smile, she turned around to where all the Democrat side of the audience, and she started clapping, and they all clapped. That's the only time that I can remember in all the debates. And then she disappeared. Candy Crowley disappeared. She was with CNN, but then it was gone.
And the Romney campaign was very angry at that after that debate over that
the argument. But I don't blame you. That's not the job of the moderator.
Jim Lehrer used to say he knew it was a good debate if people forgot that he moderated.
Who was it? Who moderated? That's right.
That's your view of what.
And Bob Schieffer has the same. You know, the same approach. They were the two who probably done most. And someone asked me the other day in one of my interviews who my favorite moderators were. And I said, well, I think we've been marvelously successful with moderators. But if I had to pick two, it would be Schieff and Jim Lehrer. And Jim did 12 of them for us over the years. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to number three here. Yep. You're saying the commission includes rules that candidates were called upon to follow, and yet it was unable or unwilling to enforce the rules in the 2020
Correct.
Debates.
Now, this is what... There are two things. As you know, we divide the 90 minutes into six 15-minute sections. And under the rules, which is they're agreed to, the moderator will ask candidate number one to a question about one of the taxes or whatever it may be. Candidate number one under the rules has 2 minutes without interruption to state his or her position. And then it's the turn without interruption for candidate number two to give their position without interruption. Well, Donald Trump broke the rule right from day one. He didn't keep the word that he was going to keep the 2 minutes. He did it all through.
And the moderator, my people, was Chris Wallace.
Chris.
Then at Fox.
Oh, Chris. And Chris did such a great job on the last debate between Hillary and Trump 4 years before. I mean, poor guy. I felt really sorry for him. I mean, you got to realize, I think, and we'll talk a little bit more about being a moderator and these things is a big deal. And I'll tell you a story about Schieff later. So that was, now what were we going to do? Was I going to jump up on the stage? Chris did everything he could to say, you're not obeying the rules. You're breaking your own rules, Chris said. So I don't know what we could have done.
Yeah.
Now, I came up with a solution for the final debate. The other thing was, in order to get in the hall in the first debate, remember, this whole thing started, I said, how am I going to handle this with the health problems that we have in the country? So I got the Cleveland Clinic to host the first debate and also to be my medical advisor.
Right. You had all of us tested who were there.
No one could get in that hall who didn't go through 2 mags and be tested that day for the masks. And so when the families were introduced, Trump family came in, they wore masks, sat down. The minute they sat down, they took their masks off. The women put it in their purses. The men put it in their pockets.
This is the Trump family.
It was not just the family. There were supporters there who were part of their entourage who sat.
Which members of the family were there that took off their masks?
Melania was there. I don't remember Barron being there, but I knew that the others were there with their girlfriends, those who weren't married, and so forth. Now, the Cleveland Clinic, because I had arranged for all this, immediately went out and tried to hand out more masks to put them on, and they wouldn't put them on. And
so what do you do in a situation like
that?
So that's
what I said. And one of the answers, I said, what was I supposed to do? Stop the debate? Call off the debate? Because they were in the audience. The candidates were up on the stage. And so they weren't happy about it. I was unhappy about it, too.
But the Biden campaign was unhappy. They wanted they wanted them to be ejected or something.
Yeah, that's right. They'd love for me to go up and take them off the stage. So that's where they were unhappy with in the rules, I think, that they're talking about. Let's see. This goes to the next page.
Yeah, I mean, they don't specify.
But I think those are the rules they're talking about.
Yes. And this gets to the next part of our conversation here with this letter, which is the list of demands. After they explain why they won't participate in your debates anymore, they say that they'll participate in two media-sponsored debates, and they lay out the demands. Some of these we've talked about, but
demands to Trump.
Yes. Yeah. Trump and or the media organization sponsoring it. And so we've talked about some of these, but we talked about the late June.
Yes.
Timing and. Very interesting. Acceptable media orgs, they had this very clever formulation of it had to be a media organization that hosted both a GOP primary debate in 2016 and a Dem primary debate in 2020.
As if they were the same. The networks have changed.
It essentially rules out Fox and MSNBC. Yeah. They want only Biden and Trump to be qualified. We discussed that. Mm-hmm. The moderator, they didn't want any ringers. Yep. Okay, that seems fair. And here's the debate format criteria they're demanding. Mm-hmm. So a firm time limit for answers. That's pretty typical.
Well, the way it used to be before we changed things was that, and we started to talk about this, the moderator with the panelist, with three reporters.
Yeah.
I told you that I was opposed to that, and we eventually changed it. We tried the experiment it was when Perot was running. It was Perot, George H.W., and Bill Clinton. It was at Michigan State. We did one half of the 90 minutes with Jim Lehrer alone as a single moderator, and the second half with the panel with moderator and three reporters. We were so happy with that where we knew, my problem was, you're reporter number one. You've worked really hard.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
To come up
yeah.
with a question yeah. and show how smart you are and brilliant you are. And you ask the question, candidate number one has 2 minutes. He answers. Candidate number two then would have 30 seconds. And then there'd be another 15 seconds for the first guy. Well, then they may not have answered the question. So reporter number two has thought very long and hard about their question and show how smart they are. They're not going to go back and double up on reporter number one's question. So they go on with their question, and it's just hanging out there.
Yeah.
So that I was always in favor
same
of getting
dynamic
rid of the
that frustrates people at every presidential press conference.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Exactly right. So, you know, we changed it, and we went forward with just a single moderator with the ability to drill down. Then we made the next bigger change at the University of Denver. Obama and, again, Romney. It's the first debate. And that's when we divided the 90 minutes into six 15-minute pods, if you will, with the moderator indicating what each pod would cover, not the questions, but what the subject matter would be in each pod. And that's where the 2-minute uninterrupted rule would be for each candidate. And then the moderator for the remainder 13 minutes could go back and forth. There was no time limit. We always have people off stage monitoring the time. We want to get as much closely as we can or not. And so the people backstage will contact the moderator and say, well, you're a little over with candidates number one, so try to get more, to try to get as best you can. And if you look at the balance, it's been pretty darn good for a long, long time. I didn't get any complaints in 2020 from either candidate that it wasn't balanced. Of course, it was hard to tell with all they were yelling over each other, but we really haven't had those problems.
And that brings us to the last requirement in the debate format that the Biden campaign demanded, which is that the candidate's microphone should only be active when it is his turn to speak.
I had a CELMIC commission on supporting me on this. The final debate last time, after the first debate, I said, what we should do is have a mute button, and that if candidate one or candidate two breaks the rule as to when he's supposed to speak or not speak, we mute his microphone. And I said if there was some way, although I never figured it out then, if we get back to this, I'll do, where a red light will go on and everyone knows that he's broken the rules and it's muted. And so we put that in, and everyone obeyed every rule in that front of the debate. No one broke it. Trump didn't. He debated. He knew we were going to turn the microphone off. And so did Joe. And both of them exactly performed perfectly well.
You didn't need the mute button, actually, in the end.
We didn't need it. We never used it.
You never used it.
In one of his statements, Trump said we used the mute. We muted his. We did not. We never muted it.
You had it available, and they knew it.
And they knew it. And we never used it.
Some people proposed after that first debate some kind of electric shock to the candidates. Yeah, did you ever consider that?
That's a good idea. I'll think about that in the future.
Giuliani was the Ron Klain on the other side. Giuliani was the Trump liaison. You talked to him after those debates, and he told you something very interesting.
Well, he called me after the election, not after the debate.
Sorry. Okay, after the election.
He called me and we chatted because he was my regular contact. I talked to him like once a week, and you know, so we talked to Klain with the problems and getting everything done. And he called me and says, you know, Mr. Chairman, he says, I believe if Donald had behaved in the first debate like he behaved in the last debate, he might very well be president-elect right now. And I said, Rudy, you may be true. It may be right. But I was told you were one of the people who told him to break the rules. He says, well, yeah, I was one of them.
That was his idea.
He agreed, yeah.
His and, 2020 campaign advice is not
you know,
standing
Rudy
up
Giuliani,
so well.
Who was, I considered him a dear friend for years. What the job he did after 9/11, I mean, he was the world's best mayor. And what has happened to the man, I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's alcohol or drugs. I just don't know. But
whether it's alcohol or drugs?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
He's not the same guy. I mean, you saw that press conference. I think it was at the RNC headquarters when he started to speak. And my wife yelled, he's bleeding. The dye was running down his face. It looked like blood. And I mean, I feel great sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Great sympathy. I don't agree with everything he did after the election, but that's a different story.
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation. I hear you. All right. So one question I have about these demands.
Yeah.
If the Biden campaign had come to you with this same list, what would your response have been?
I'd have told him what, because we have not announced yet the format.
Right. You haven't?
No, we've announced the dates, everything else, but we haven't announced the formats and we haven't announced the moderators.
So we're all just assuming that you'll do the formats of recent years, but that's not set in stone.
That's not in stone, but my guess is it will. It will be the same, the 90 minutes divided into 6 15-minute pods. I'm assuming we're going to go with the mute button again, and that's how we would do it. But I wouldn't want, after the 2 minutes on each side, I wouldn't want then 1 minute here and 1 minute there. We want the moderator to be able to follow up and to drill down on the positions that they're saying to make sure the American people are getting. And I have.
And do you think that's precluded in this
letter? I don't
know.
It doesn't. It's a little general here. I don't know what they would say about that. And I've never really discussed it with them, but they didn't. They didn't complain in the debate, the final debate, about how it went and so forth.
It means a lot coming from you because you've known him for a long time.
I have. In fact, I'll tell you a story. When he was vice president and I was at Harvard, Harvard gave my wife and I a 3-bedroom apartment fully furnished right in the middle of campus. In the apartment above us was Joe's sister. She was also a resident fellow. And so she arranged for Joe, the vice president, to come. Have you ever been in the big Harvard Kennedy Center where the big room and so forth where the speakers come?
Yes.
And I mean, he came and students were hanging from the rafters. There must have been 1,200, 1,500 people in there. And so she was sitting next to me and the debate. So Joe is introduced and he comes out and he says, I understand Frank Farrenkopf's in here. And this is in 17, 18? And I look like this. I said, nobody. He's, ladies and gentlemen, he says, that man over there, we've known each other for 20, 25 years. We disagree on political issues, but we respect each other and we get along. And that's what we're missing in Washington and so forth. And that's a fine sit down. So 3 or 4 times during the debate, he said, Isn't that right, Frank? And so when the debate was over, she turned to me and she said, you son of a bitch. I'm the one who got him here. And he mentioned you and didn't mention me. She's a piece of work. And this is a woman who.
Well, yes, she ran all the campaigns up to the president, up
that's
until
what
the
she
presidential.
Said, starting with the 7th grade, she says. And of course, she's the one who moved in after his daughter daughter and wife were killed and raised the boys.
Yeah. Yeah. I think she was always a little disappointed that she wasn't invited into the White House for an official role, you know, with an office and all that. All right. I have some questions. This is an opportunity for you to turn the tables on the sponsoring organizations of the debate. You guys are always asked tough questions about your rules. I want to ask you a few questions about CNN and ABC and how we don't know all the details, but there's always great intrigue around the memorandum of understanding. this document that is negotiated between the two campaigns.
They don't do them anymore for us. We don't deal with them. We've never been part of a member of understanding. I don't think the candidates have actually done one since 2000.
It's been that long, huh?
Yeah.
Because all that stuff is set.
We don't pay any
attention. So the little stuff like temperature and all that stuff, that you guys handled all of that since 2000.
Yeah, I mean, Al Gore was a sweater.
So they wanted it cool.
He wanted it cool. If you've been in the hall, the hall's really cold. I tell women who are coming, you bring them past Mina, because with the cameras and the lights, it's cold in there.
Yeah.
But Al was a sweater, and he wanted us to reduce, I think it's to 65. He wanted us down to 50. We can't do that.
To 50?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
That's so, really cool. And we'll make modifications like that.
Got it. But that's a more casually negotiated.
Casually negotiated. Now, we wanted one year, we specifically said that one of the presidential debates would be done seated at a table.
Right.
And Obama, and I can't remember which race it was, and the opponent said they'd be more comfortable having the podiums. And we didn't argue with him. Now, I still think that the nature and tenor of discourse changes when you've got people sitting at a table with the moderator in between. It's just the podiums tend to be like walls.
Perform more. Now that you're saying this, I think back to the debates where I remember people seated. There's a certain casualness about it.
It really is.
What are the big old questions in your mind?
Well, right now, again, I could be wrong. I've heard that CNN has said that they will not share the results of that thing. It won't be out.
No simulcast.
We use the White House. Okay, our stuff's White House.
Use the White House pool.
That's correct.
To send it out to everyone.
And it goes out. And, you know, Nielsen says, well, the first debate last time was 78, 80 million. Bullshit. It's 120 million. They don't count C-SPAN. They don't count things that are online. And we work with all the platforms. All the platforms are with us and work with us. And those people aren't counted. It's just those people who are watching on television networks.
So where does that line it up in terms of most watched television events just in a normal year?
It would be really, it depends. You know, the worst was Dole Clinton.
Yeah,
it was because the race was out of
hand. Snoozer re-election, yeah.
And I think there's no question that Hillary and Donald, that first debate was very big.
Yeah.
And I think the first debate this time was very big. I haven't looked at the numbers in a long, long time.
But among the most, is there anything that competes in terms of ratings, like the Super Bowl perhaps?
Got the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Super Bowl is probably the biggest competitor.
So what will that do? I did some.
Well, if it's just CNN.
It's just CNN, which is in, I understand, 80 million households out of 130 million households in the U.S., you know, you think everyone has CNN, but it's not actually the case.
I mean,
so what does
it's
going to
limit very much in the number of people who are going to see it. Now, ABC, I think, has said they will share.
That's what I've –
They
yes.
will share. I don't know whether they're going to be all the platforms that we use.
So you have two questions. Will they share and will everyone take it?
Yes.
Yeah, everyone takes the CPD debate.
Yep. Everyone takes the CPD.
Right.
Yep.
All the news organizations, the big networks –
And everyone does. Yep.
And so, even though ABC is going to simulcast it, Fox News may not want an ABC branded event on its.
Well, let me tell you what happened in 2000. I don't remember whether it was Carl or Joe. Oh God, one of the Governor Bush's people. They came to town. We had proposed three presidential, one vice presidential, the same, and said, "Well, we've decided." The governor is going to go out in front of the governor's mansion in Austin and announce he's going to do three debates. First debate will be with the commission. The second debate will be on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. And the third debate will be on Larry King's show on CNN. And I said, are you out of your fucking minds? Do you really believe, the other networks are going to cover something that's on Meet the Press or vice versa and so forth. It's presidential debate. And I said, I think you're making a big mistake. Big mistake. They came back 10 days later with their tail between their legs because conservative, liberal, moderate, newspapers, everything, radio, this is idiotic. Don't do it, blah, blah. And they came back and they ended up doing our debates, even though they said they weren't going to do it.
And they publicly announced the former.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting historical precedent.
Yes, which is, reminds me a little bit of this.
Everyone says the Commission on Presidential Debates is dead.
We ain't dead yet.
Like that Monty Python skit.
We ain't dead yet. And we'll be...
This is just a flesh wound.
Yeah, we're going to be there. And I'll say this.
Look, how do you get it back?
Well, I look at it this way. We were created for one purpose and one purpose only. All of us on this commission from day one, we're not compensated in any way. No one's paid, but our staff is paid. And what we want to make sure in every presidential election cycle, that the man or woman who want to be president, vice president of the United States, debates their opponents. That's our purpose. Now, if they're able to accomplish it, if the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign can reach some agreement and go forward with two debates, I mean, I guess Trump wanted another one that they've said, no, you agreed to this other thing. No further debates, no discussions, no debate on
the
debate.
The Biden campaign is controlling this.
They're close. And it happens, and they do a good job and so forth. We'll salute them. Good job. Because that's the only thing we exist for. I don't get anything out of this any other way. And what happens to the debate commission thereafter? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I'm sure it will continue. What you're going to see, and you should really spend, you don't have to do it right now, but I want to make sure because no one really knows.
Anything you want to point to, do it. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Because the town hall meeting, which is usually the second debate.
Yes.
Which you introduced in 1992.
Yep.
Probably a good thing for Bill Clinton.
Yes, it was.
That was the famous one where George H.W. Bush looked at his watch, I believe.
I was sitting right off stage. Pamela Harriman was sitting between Paul Kirk and I.
One of your board members?
One of our board members. She was a sexy old lady. She really was. And we were in front of us was a panel that showed what every television station was showing. And the minute George was caught and everything, she was looking at the watch, she reached over and she put her fingers right here and she said, Frank, darling, it's over. It's over.
She had a weird accent because she was... Yeah.
Well, she was married to Winston Churchill's son, and she lived at the Churchill's through World War II. Yeah. And
she was politically sophisticated enough to know in real time that was devastating to Bush.
That's exactly right.
That's impressive.
She was something else.
Just want to follow up on the town hall. The Biden campaign has ruled that out. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the research over the years has shown that that's the most popular. Tell people about that.
Most popular of it. It's interesting. It's a real pain for us, to be very candid with you, because we would have 100 people being chosen by the Gallup organization who say they're undecided, and we bring them in the morning, and we have to feed them. most of them have never in their life ever held a microphone in their hand. I mean, we don't know if they're going to end up. I'll tell you how the questions are done. But I remember, I forget what year it was, the woman, we gave it to hold her in her hand. She was shaking. And they said, what's your name? She couldn't talk. She was so terrified she couldn't even talk. So for the average person, it is really a tragedy.
I don't remember that one. I'm always struck by how impressive those people are, having never done that before.
They spend the days. Now, something happened in San Diego, at the University of San Diego. I think it was Dole and Clinton, where three people in a row were chosen by the moderator, and they asked the same question. So what we did since then is that we have them together. They all have a pad and pencil. This is, if you want to ask a question of the candidates today, write your question out and give it to the moderator. And the only one who sees those pieces of paper are the moderator. And he or she will go through to make sure there's no duplication and decides which question will be asked so that we avoid having the same question asked more than one time.
And you guys are never involved with the question selection?
We're not involved. We're never involved in the question selection. That would be interfering with journalistic integrity. We don't do it.
Did you ever have any concern that the campaigns had inappropriately contacted the moderators or got a heads up about questions or ever any suspicions
kind? You know, we know what happened in the Democratic primaries.
Yes, yeah, of course.
We know what happened in the Democratic primaries where Hillary did get the hint of the questions. She was acting chairman of the DNC at the time.
The Donna Brazile thing.
And our moderators, what we do is we monitor them. We get a list. We get a short list that Janet and I and our staff, we come up maybe with 10 reporters, 10 people.
How do you build your initial list for the moderators?
It's a small group of us on the board, the executive committee and the board, and we have our director who directs the thing and who's very experienced in television and for years. And we sort of get a little group together, and then we start watching them if they're on television, radio, or media. We read what they want to see. You know, I don't know if you can ever get someone right down the middle anymore. That's our goal, to find someone down the middle. So we do our best to find someone as closest to the middle as possible. And when we talk to them and ask them whether they would consider, with the understanding that they're not going to take sides in the debates, and that's how we end up doing it.
Have you ever picked someone who said, no, I don't want to do it?
Yes, I had one person, and it was not for, they didn't want to do it. Help me. Diane Sawyer. I called Diane and ask her to do one. And she said, Frank, I'd love to do it. And then she started crying. Her husband was in the hospital. Remember, he was in the hospital for a year before he died.
Okay.
And she says, I spend every day at the hospital with him. And so she was the only one that I've ever contacted who said no. Sometimes I'll contact somebody, Janet May or Paul Kirk may have at the time, whoever we assigned to make the contact of the moderator. But she was the only one that I ever talked to. But it wasn't because she wouldn't do it, and I knew she would, because I knew Diane. Well, she really covered all the debates, was always up on the platform and all the rest of it, and the conventions.
What do you think of the choices that have been announced? Jake Tapper and Dana Bash at CNN.
I know all four of them. And
David Muir at ABC and his co-moderator will be.
I don't know David as well as.
I guess my question is, are they moderators that would have been in the mix for the CPD debates?
Yeah, we'd looked at everybody. I'm not sure. And I don't want to insult them or say something that's not true. I just don't know at this point in time.
Yeah. Why should your group, a group of unelected Washington officials, get to decide who the moderators are, when the debates are, where they are? Why should it be you guys through a process that some people would say is not that transparent? And correct me if you think any of the premises wrong.
Who else would choose them? One of the reasons we were created was that the candidates over 100 were canceled. Who's going to agree? And it was just so we're down the middle. We're nonpartisan. We're neutral, and we're trying to make decisions on who should be the moderator based not on whether it's going to help my side or the other side, but who's going to do the best job of getting these candidates to tell the American people where they stand on the issues. You know, there's one other part of the debates that I think is very, very important. I've always looked at it as two things happen. If a debate is a good debate, number one, you've informed the American people where the candidates stand on issues that are important to them in their daily lives and so forth. The other was they get a feeling for the people. Who are these candidates? What's their personalities? Do they obey the rules? Are they courtesy? Is there courtesy there? It's very, very important. I've asked a lot of times, Frank, what have you learned after doing 33 debates? Is that the American
33, people, that's the number.
33, presidential, vice presidential. What have you learned? I said, I've learned that the American people would really like to like their president. And so I think that they're not only making decisions based upon the answers that are given, but how they handle themselves. I always felt Al Gore hurt himself with what he did. And I don't know if you remember, the first debate in that round was held in Boston.
The sighing debate.
Uh-huh.
The sighing debate.
Yeah, and he came out with all this red rouge on his
leg. Oh, yeah.
They'd hired this girl who was an excellent in colors and so forth. I mean,
the brown suits, I know what you're talking about.
Paul Kirk was saying, holy mackerel, what the hell's the matter with him? You know, and so I think Al hurt himself. And there's no question that Trump really hurt himself in the first debate last time. So I think that they're getting a perception on the human being that's up there. As well as learning where that person is and where they stand on the issues.
If you don't get to a 34th debate and the CPD is gone, what do you think we will have lost?
Well, I think we'd have lost a lot. I say that because, unfortunately, I am really worried for my grandkids what kind of country we're going to have. So many traditions, so much respect for other people, freedom to speak what your mind is and cares about without wondering whether someone's going to woke you online. People are afraid to take positions because of that. The Harvard and Columbia and some of these schools were never going to be the same. They're never going to be the same with what's happening. There's a difference between peaceful and unpeaceful. In fact, so you know where we're going as a country. People don't respect each other, and like I said, Paul Kirk and Chuck were my close friends, and that just doesn't exist anymore. It's scary. It's scary.
All right, Frank, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate it.
Yep.
The last question on this show is always proposed by our last guest. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you the question from our last guest, who happens to have been Speaker Mike Johnson. Mm-hmm. And then while you're answering that, come up with a question for our next guest, who you don't know who it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And his question, he said, what makes you proud to be an American?
That's a very good question. That's one of the things I'm concerned about with the younger generation. I came from nothing. My dad was an automobile mechanic, worked in a gas station. He kidnapped my sister and I when I was 9 years old. And in those days—
Your father kidnapped you and your sister?
Yeah. In those days, you could only get a divorce in one place in the United States. This is 1949. And that was in Nevada. And he and my mom had been not getting along. They eventually got divorced later and went out to Reno. And for the first 6 months, we lived in a bus that didn't have wheels on and with an outside bathroom. And we, you know, started from scratch. I worked my way through through college. I went in the Army. I read at a high school. There was a draft on. I served at Fort Ord in California. And then came back to the University of Nevada, Reno. And I worked a couple of places. I worked at the YMCA, and then I worked in the post office. I went and collected mail from all the mailboxes and threw it at night and so forth. And my wife, who I've been married to now for 62 years, she came from nothing also. And she worked and put me through law school at the University of California, Berkeley. I was there in the left-wing capital of the world. And then I went back to Reno, and I, you know, slowly started. I started as a lawyer at $500 a month.
Wow.
In Reno, Nevada. And then, you know, then I worked and I got involved in politics. And I served my country. And in a way, I've looked at the debate commission and my time and effort in all these years is part of also of my responsibility for my country, because I think having those debates is so important for democracy and freedom. And that's why I do it. And I know this country, and I have great confidence in this country. I'm concerned. But I had the great experience as chairman to be with Ronald Reagan as he traveled the world. Pope John Paul II, I got to know very, very well. Margaret Thatcher, all my children got to meet those leaders. And so I just believe in democracy. I started something called the International Republican Institute and the National Endowment for Democracy, which still are very much involved. So I believe in our system, and I believe in the future will be great, but I'm just worried about where we are.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't know if that answers the question.
But it does. Thank you for that.
Now what the hell do I ask?
And it can be anything. It doesn't have to be a grand question like that. It can be a specific one. You know, generally we have political guests, but sometimes not. We don't. So, you know, the main criteria is it's got to apply to a large universe of people, but be as provocative or as you know as you'd like.
What did you think of Snyder, the owner of the Washington football team?
Okay, that's a good one. Frank, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and really enjoyed this conversation.
Good.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.